If you enjoy this podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to catch all future episodes. Also, check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/switchboxtv for video versions of this show, plus loads more videos covering sport, music, and lifestyle. That's youtube.com/switchboxtv. This episode was recorded in August 2020.
How are you? You're right.
I'm all right, man. It's hot here today. It's pushing 90 degrees in New York. So,
well, don't show off. It's been raining here. Hello, welcome to the Need to Know Music Show with me, Ronan McManus, on Switchbox TV. And today I'm joined by Brendan Brown from Wheatus, who, you know, they're celebrating the 20th anniversary of their debut album and the iconic song Teenage Dirtbag. I'd just like to welcome you, Brendan, to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good, Ronan. Thanks for having me, man. We're doing okay. It's a strange year, but we're making what we can of it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, how have you been sort of dealing with the last 6 months or so? Where have you been?
You know, best laid plans and all that. We had 250 work days booked. A lot of that was on the road, and it all got wiped out. Obviously, quite a bit of the work we're doing on the re-record and the reissue of our first album has been delayed, but about, it's looking like about 3 months at the moment, about worth of delay, because COVID and lots of other reasons, it's just been a little bit hard to keep the schedule we were keeping. But we're still planning on the full 20 song vinyl release, and I think the digital is going to be 23 songs. It'll be the 10 original tracks that you're familiar with from our first album, but then an additional 13 or so tracks that were lost in the sauce over the years. So,
yeah. So you've actually completely re-recorded the original tracks. But having heard the Teenage Dirtbag, it's you're pretty faithful to the original, and you wouldn't know the difference, I don't think. I mean, how was that a thing you did on? Just wanted to recreate it exactly how it was. Was there no temptation to sort of go, we can just do this a different way now? Or what was your thought process with that?
So obviously, you know, I'm 46 years old. And when I wrote the song, I was maybe 20, 23, 24 years old. Like, so I think that one of the big challenges was to see if we could still do it at all, you know, like still bring that energy into a track and catch the lightning in a bottle a second time. The other issue was, the original multi-track masters seem to have been misplaced or lost. The tape format that we used for that record was as things were in the late 90s, early 2000s, an early digital transitional format that didn't last very long past our using it, and will have had to have been updated to Pro Tools or you know, sort of like backed up to Pro Tools, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't. So despite us having provided four copies of the complete master recordings to Sony back in the day, I don't think they backed it up. So it seems as though the original multi-tracks are lost and gone for good. And we felt that loss pretty acutely over the years, not being able to license to video games or any of the, you know. So we wanted to fill that gap and put it back together and bring back what once was. Something that we worked very hard on and made it a long time ago. So we put the effort in and reconjured it somehow.
I mean, it's one of those iconic songs that I've been in covers bands over the years, and people still always coming up to me asking for that song, and people who weren't even born when it was released are asking for that song. I mean, I know that as a songwriter, you kind of, you know, you've done so much stuff over the years. I've been looking through everything, and it's but you can't escape the fact that it's such a huge song for you. And so what do you think it is about Teenage Dirtbag that kind of makes it so timeless, because it still sounds as fresh every time you hear it on the radio. It has done the last 20 years. It still works. Is there any magic in that that you think?
Well, the magic wasn't magic at all. It was toil. It took from 1995, when I sort of started demoing the song, through to the year 1999 when we got the record deal, and then we finally committed it to tape for the fourth and final time in March of the year 2000, and it was released that summer. I redesigned it, you know, I don't know how many times, trying to find this hybrid of, you know, acoustic guitars from James Taylor and a vocal from Paul Simon in the verses, but not in the choruses, more of a Rush or a Prince thing in the choruses. And the guitars in the choruses had to be somewhere between Metallica and AC/DC, and the drums had to be hip hop all throughout, but also really find that sweet spot on the rock and roll snare drum and the hi-hat energy. And that hybrid was difficult to come to. Lots of back to the drawing board all through 96, 97, 98. There's this sort of evolutionary set of demos that you can check out. Eventually we intend to make them public, but and I think even one of those early drum machine versions is on YouTube somewhere. I think somebody found it, but we were tearing it down and building it back up again for 4 or 5 years before it came to a place where it was a successful hybrid of all these things we were influenced by and statements I wanted to make, in particular with guitar and drums, I wanted a Motown feel on the bass, you know, and these seemingly disparate production aesthetics. We're being approached by somebody who had no real production experience. So part of the problem was if we went into a real studio, let's say we lucked out and nabbed a real big time producer, I wouldn't have known what to tell them, you know, about what.
Right, yeah.
So it made sense to be in the woodshed for a little longer and try and figure out what we were trying to say. And that's valuable time. I don't think real bands get these days.
That's true. I mean, I know that you hear that story about Fairy Tale in New York, the Pogues, the iconic, the best ever Christmas song ever written. That a similar sort of story. It went through so many different changes, so many different ways before they actually finally landed on the right one. When you had the final one, did you know that was the final one?
Yeah, it was pretty. When it clicked into, we started experimenting with the final technique in late 99. And then when we went into the studio, our studio that we built in my mother's house, I should say, with this gear you see behind you stacked up over my poor mother's living room. we knew what we wanted to buy at that point. We had enough experience to know what kind of microphones we needed to use these hybrids to create these hybrids with. And when we went in and we finished it, we knew it was, we didn't know it would be a hit, but we knew that the strange hybrid we were trying to conjure up had been accomplished against the odds. So we were satisfied with that. And unfortunately that took so much energy that a lot of the other songs on the record didn't get that kind of attention, you know. I guess we could have spent another 8 years trying to turn all those songs in. but we rushed through the rest of it and wound up with one song that really had a lot more attention paid to it than the others on the production side. I've always been happy about that, though. The song precedes us. It's kind of our ambassador. It does a lot of the dirty work for us, the managing, the you know, the lawsuits, the whatever the bullshit that music industry has. Teenage Dirtbag is like this weapon that comes in and is like, you know, we it does a lot of our fighting for us. But I'm happy to be, you know, when I was 10 or 11 years old and I was dressing up as AC, you know, Angus Young for Halloween and having my SG and my tape case full of his records and the, you know, Bon Scott and Brian Johnson records, and I would have taken any version of what those guys were doing as my life, you know.
Absolutely.
I'm quite happy with how it turned out.
Tell us about the 10 extra songs that people are going to be hearing. As I understand it, they're not songs that were written at the time. They're kind of songs that have been written over the course of your career and have kind of put in the vibe of that first album. Is that the right?
So one of them is already on Spotify, is released as the B-side to the Teenage Dirtbag 2020 single, which just hit Spotify and iTunes and all the other streaming services. It's called a song called Mope. And Mope was written back in the day, back in the first decade of the 2000s, sometime when, I don't exactly know when, but it was a return to that first album kind of like vibe and feeling. And it didn't feel like it fit on anything we were working on at the time. So it got shelved, and there was a, you know, again, 13 or more like 10 other instances of that through the years where it was a little bit like, that's cool, but it sounds like the first album, you know, and then it got put aside. So we wound up with a fair collection of those returns to form. And now they have a place finally and an excuse to get recorded and put out. So it's like the almost like an alternate universe version of our first album, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, it's the kind of like the Back to the Future when he skews off into the alternate timeline.
Yeah. But we're in the one where Biff is running the show now. So.
But just so just in case anybody thought that your career consisted of writing Teenage Dirtbag and then sipping margaritas the rest of your life, you've got a fairly colourful. You've had a fairly colourful time, I think it's fair to say. Looking at your obstacle course career, where you've had like falling out with a major label, lineup changes, even had a computer server crash delaying an album release, and then just when you're about to sort of go on this 20th anniversary sort of victory lap tour, you're hit by a global pandemic. I mean, you guys don't seem to be able to catch a break here. Yeah. But tell us a little bit about. You've had a fair amount of challenges over the years, it's fair to say, isn't it?
I'm actually comfortable with this now because it's kept us pretty well grounded, but our moments in the sun have always been almost immediately out, you know, clouded over, you know. The first time we hit the road and it was going to be a real big tour in these big theaters and the corn exchanges in England and in Europe, September 11th happened. So we slashed like 2/3 of that tour out and had to pick up the pieces. It seems like every time we rise to the occasion comes and gives us a hard one. You know? Although what that's done is it's afforded us the opportunity to figure out how to survive in the changing, you know, I mean, we're a band from the 90s really, and being able to adapt to touring and social media in 2020, I think if we'd gone way up to the rare air in the first, chapter of this whole thing, I think we would either fallen really hard or never come down. And you know what those people are like, they can't relate anymore. So, we never really left the ground. The feet were always on the ground as a result. And we learned how to, you know, make our own records and build our own rigs and fix our own computer systems when they crash and, load our own gear into a venue and you know, in the traffic in London, you know, that kind of stuff. It's all us back there on the trailer, like wheeling stuff in and out in the rain. So, you know, we never got comfy and safe. And I don't think I would have enjoyed the challenge as much had we become comfy and safe and, you know, had everybody doing things for us. So I feel like we lucked out in that regard. I'm very proud of the fact that we can handle almost any kind of touring environment, and any kind of adversity in the studio. We kind of tinker around until we figure it out. You know, so self-sufficient is the alternative to.
I was going to say the sort of situation that bands find themselves now in the modern music business. With the kind of the major labels kind of not really being what they were and having to deal with doing the DIY releasing. I mean, you've been using a lot of those techniques over the years, when you renamed the album Suck Phony, and you made it available on the website only for two years. And then you've done a pay what you want thing. I mean, that was 2010, that was 10 years ago you were doing that. These are kind of sort of well-trodden paths for modern bands. It seems like you've been doing this thing for a long time.
Going all the way back to 98, 99, I was working at a computer company in Times Square, in New York City, and I had one of our demo CDs that we were giving them away at the shows we were playing in New York, right? And the guy who ran the computer company, he came up to me and says, "Is that your record?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you know, it's, you know, once it's on that disc, it's a piece of software that can be, you know, emailed around and sent around, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, I think I kind of understand what you're saying." And we had this conversation in 98 about the fact the physical music was over, that it was, the cat was out of the bag, and whether or not the record labels know it, they're selling software now. So I kind of, unfortunately in some regards and fortunately, knew about that working in the computer industry beforehand, and was kind of ready for it and was giving music away up front. Our second record, I pitched to Sony that they print up only 1 million copies in carbon neutral jackets and give them away. And then I proposed, well, we split the touring and we split the merchandise and we make a big splash with giving a record away. This was 2002. And they laughed me out of the fucking room, man. They thought I was nuts. They were, get rid of this kid.
And then sort of fast forward 10 years and they're slapping 360 deals on bands and trying to take a cut off their touring and their merch.
Exactly. So I you know, I don't want to say I was ahead of our time. I just think that the record labels were behind it. That's all. Like, it wasn't being ahead. It was just them being behind. So I'm excited. The idea of a distro that's weird and free, or, you know, breaks the rules, that's always been appealing to me, just, you know, forever and ever. I mean, when I was a kid, trying to find stuff out about bands that I liked was almost impossible because you couldn't look on the internet. You couldn't download their, like, you know, outtakes and demos and stuff like you can now. So, I mean, I was always hungry for that, and now it's here, and I feel like it's an opportunity, not a hindrance, you know.
And you guys have got a Patreon.
Yeah.
Have you found, because it's come up a few times, because this show we kind of speak to a lot of up and coming musicians as well as established. So we kind of, a lot more people are using that Patreon model. How are you finding it?
So back in 2015 or so, maybe even 2014, we started doing live streaming on Facebook of you know, like our rehearsals, just and then taking requests and everything real live and real dirty, you know, shitty video. The audio we fed in from our rehearsal sound desk, but the you know, it was crappy, but it was technically back in the day now, and now fast forwarding, Matthew, our bass player, is coming over today so that we can start tinkering with the prototype for four camera interactive Zoom concerts that are fully request, right? So we have tons of laptops in this band because that's all we use on the road. So we're gonna have four laptops set up in different rooms, COVID safe with the mask and everything, but we're gonna be in the same house but in different rooms, being broadcast onto one Zoom screen, and we're gonna be able to have that be a sort of like where we're kind of interviewing the people who are watching and saying, okay, you know, your choice is up next. What do you want to hear? And tell us about it. Tell us why. And then,
wow, that's,
yeah, exactly. So like, can you imagine doing your favorite band? I think about that. All the time. I'm like, man, could I have just done that with like, you know, Rush, like, I'd have, you know, so it's very exciting. I think, you know, we're gonna work to try and work the kinks out of the system. We did find out, pro tip, if you have an actual Ethernet, physical Ethernet connection, it works quite a bit better than your Wi-Fi on your laptop or your phone. So that's a note.
So I've heard the same thing, because it creates its own connection rather than you don't get interfered with by your kids on their iPads or whatever it is in the other room.
I'm on an Ethernet cable right here. So
yeah,
we got a hub, and we're going to build a little Zoom network that's unique in the house, and the same location where we do all of our recording. So all this gear is going to be incorporated. You're going to get the best audio delivery that we're able to give. And it's going to be interactive, and we're going to work on this until we get it right. It's going to have some bumps in the road, I'm sure, but we're going to figure it out, you know?
That's amazing. I think that's been the biggest challenge for musicians during the lockdown is how to, you know, obviously there's no gigs, trying to find a way of doing that that's authentic. And Facebook Live thing's been okay. Most people, the best ones are kind of bringing the pre-records out, then edited together afterwards and kind of put out as live. But to be able to, obviously you can't Zoom with multiple different people because you've got the delay means you can't play at the same time. So this seems like a really brilliant way of doing it, to actually have an authentic, and you're effectively doing a gig for one each time, which is a fantastic idea. I think it's a way that we're going to have to innovate to keep going.
Yeah. So the Zoom environment affords that opportunity where you can be personable on a one-to-one basis, and everybody else gets a piece of it without that. So, you know, a show is fun. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love a rock show. But at this point we can't do it. So what's the other opportunity? Well, the other opportunity is to become really, really, like, truly conversational about the aspect of playing live music, and just break it down. I mean, there's no crowd barrier anymore. We don't have to have that. We can listen to each other. We can process the information in real time, and we can put it into the performance just like that, you know? So that's what I'm looking forward to. And we have this thing we've been doing on Sundays on the Patreon's Zoom casts, where the people who are on there challenge me with a song I don't know that well, a cover song or something, you know, like something I maybe played when I was 12, and now I have to figure it out again. He's like, let's see how quickly I can figure out how that goes right here in front of you, and see if I can remember how to play Walk This Way or, you know, some other thing. And see, just vibe it. Just see what happens. And you find out so much more about music when you approach it from that constructive or deconstructive, you know, like, what is this? What are we doing? I'm not quite sure. I remember that chord. What was that chord? Oh, no, don't look it up. Let me see if I can find it, you know. That's valuable to me.
Absolutely. A Google-free zone. No, is that a Googling thing?
A personal zone.
It's in there somewhere. It's in there. It's all in there.
It has been.
What's the next step for you guys? And obviously this, I mean, embracing the online medium is something that I think, rather than trying to create a live show, you know, I mean, embracing it, making it something unique so that can actually have some longevity is fantastic. So you're doing these, is that all on your Patreon, those where can people get the hold of those?
We've been doing this thing where, so obviously Patreon is, there's a membership fee and so on. However, Matthew, our bass player, bless him, has figured out how to live broadcast on YouTube. The only downside to watching it on YouTube is it's not interactive. But, you know, the Patreon exists for people who want to have the interactive experience. So it's a free concert for all intents and purposes, and that we get to monetize later and stays up there, remains in the internet. And at the same time, if you want to pay much, much less than a ticket price to interact with us on the show, you can choose the Patreon Zoom feed and be part of the Zoom cast yourself. So this is the plan. I mean, we're building towards it technologically speaking. Matthew and I are setting up the router today to run, you know, four Zoomcast laptops at the same time. And we're going to figure out how to do this. I mean, some way we have to, you know.
Absolutely. It sounds really exciting. And we'll make sure we put the link underneath so people can click that and go to Patreon and join that. Or they can check out your YouTube and things like that. So, so the plans are shelved for now for the 20th anniversary tour. I know the single's out now, isn't it? You get Teenage Dirtbags out now, but is there about the rest of the album? Is the whole thing delayed 3 months, or what's the time frame?
We're kind of redesigning that as we speak. I think that one of the things we had to wait for, and this was a little bit of like looking under the hood at how this all works. We had to be careful that when we released Teenage Dirtbag, as close as it is to the original, that it wasn't claimed by Sony in any way. And back in April, when Rolling Stone put the new Dirtbag up on their site, we instantly got a claim from Sony Music, and they thought it was the original. So we fooled the bots, I guess, but that's not... it's a good thing and a bad thing, because then we had to appeal to the Sony legal department to make sure that they understood that there were no elements of the original in this new iteration. So the lawyer got involved, and we went back and forth. It took about 9 weeks to get our clearance on that. And then in June or mid-June, we were finally able to say, okay, we know it's ours now. Now that's out of the way. We've kind of proven the point. We have a precedent for claiming our own copyright on this. I got the new copyright established with the American U.S. Copyright Office. And now what do we do? You know, now it was like COVID's over. We got the copyright, or not over, but it's COVID's happening. We got the copyright. And then we started talking about, well, what if we release them instead of all in one batch, we release them in pairs. So like, here's Teenage Dirtbag, and here's the Teenage Dirtbag from the alternate universe, right? And so that's what we're going to do moving forward. I think it's a pretty solid way to keep people updated in a sort of like in an episodic kind of way. Dirtbag and Mope went together. They're in key. They have that same sort of like bigness. And then the next two songs, I'm not going to tell you what they are yet, but we're going to do one of the originals from the first album, and it's Antimatter Particle from the alternate universe. Single pairs, you know.
So you've got kind of young Biff and old Biff from to keep the Back to the Future analogy.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So when do you have a time frame of when the next one is going to be out?
We're going to try and get maybe 4 or 5 pairs of songs out before the end of the year, before Christmas. My goal has been to finish this before the end of 2020, because it was 2020 was the year our first album was released. But that's only in the United States. The record came out overseas in 2001. In your country, it was in March or February of 2001, and the subsequent European territories and Australia were all in that same time period. The single came out in December in Australia, but the rest of the record wasn't out for a bit. So we're kind of still on target in a chronological sense for exactly 20 years. But the new post in the ground for the full release coming out is now the UK release date, which is going to be 20 years in March, I think, or February. I can't remember which. I'll look it up. But that's kind of the new COVID post in the ground, you know.
Yeah, it's that kind of movable post, isn't it? It's very malleable, these posts in the ground above me.
I don't want it to linger. I want to, you know, I'm nearly done finished with all the singing, and I'll give you a little bit of a bird's eye view here of this is where we're mixing the record. This is our workstation and our console, and this is all the gear that we're using to make it. You know, this is all of some of the original gear from our first album and the things that we used on it, plus a couple of neat little tidbits that we've added over the years. So,
that's the ultimate musician's man cave right there.
It's scary. It's the dark, dismal place, you know? But this is where you make the special thing about your music. This is where you make it unique. This is where you make it unforgettable, by turning these dials until something magic happens. So, you know, we're still doing it, as you can see, the analog way. Our recording system, the multi-track, is a DSD recording system in a Windows machine, but we don't mix or process any of the sound in the computer. It's all original analog processing. So when you hear it, it's like, it's as old school as it gets, man. It's dirty. I thought about tape machines, but they're such a hassle and they don't really bring that much to the table, in my opinion, that you can't figure out in other ways. So, short of a tape machine, we're doing it the old way.
Nice. And there's, but me, there's plenty of music, for people to check out. I mean, you've been releasing pretty much constantly through the last 20 years. So as much as it's great to celebrate that first album, there's so much more you've been doing in over the last 20 years. And, you know, through adversity, as we've already discussed, there's been a fair amount of hurdles in your way. But, if there was a track that you could pick out, that you'd really like people to sort of just that you know, you feel maybe could be bigger or would have, you'd like to have been as big as Teenage Dirtbag, what would you go for?
That's an interesting question. Mostly I never ever even tried to write anything like that. I mean, that was it. Once that was finished, I wanted to go somewhere else. I didn't want to have a sequel or the closest that anything came to that in terms of accessibility would be maybe Lemonade. Close. Another other proud moments along the way include Real Girl is a fun one. It's a big distorted sort of emo kind of track, I guess you could call it. And then on our most recent 2013, we released the Valentine LP. That's got a song called Valentine, the title track. I'm really into that one. Other ones, you know, Tipsy and Lullaby are two singles that we put out that are kind of like right off of the seventh record, what will eventually be the seventh record. And in that regard, I think Lullaby is my sort of, for me, my most proud moment for arrangement and writing, because it's effectively like a jazz song. And I am an untrained musician. I don't read music. I don't know anything about the circle of fifths other than what my bandmates tell me. I sat for a long time and memorized and rememorized this chord progression that I don't know what the chords are actually called. I know it's in the key of E, but I wanted to try and figure out how to write a jazz song and finish it properly. And Lullaby is that. Lullaby is way up at the limit of what I'm able to do as a songwriter in complexity and harmonic, I guess you would call it substitution, where it's not what you think it's gonna be kind of thing. So I'm quite proud of that. It's not everybody's cup of tea. It's a dirty, big sounding, weird song, but I'm quite proud of having pulled off the arrangement. And other than that, there's not a lot of, I don't really have any like moments of cringiness. There's a few cringe moments on our first record for me that are kind of like, that could have sounded better, you know.
Everybody has those times when you look back at stuff it's a long time, 20 years in your development. And
yeah.
But you know, all that goes into what has made you what you are now. All those songs, all that progression. It's all part of the ingredients.
Yeah, all that regret.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what your sort of highlight of your career has been in a sense of live gigs.
Oh wow. I tell you, we on our last tour, we played a show at King Tut's in Scotland.
Scotland, in Glasgow, yeah.
I mean, you know, we work hard to be practiced. We rehearse a lot, and every once in a while, the crowd knows it, and they have a moment where they say, "No, we need to jump into this," and they bring the same energy, and it has to be an interesting combination. You know, we have to have had the right sleep, the jet lag has to have worn off, nobody in the band is sick or nursing a chest cold or any of that nonsense, and it just where everyone's kind of clicking and we know what we're there for, and the crowd is there for the same reason. That King Tut show on the last tour was like, holy crap, you know. And we've played some great shows on the Busted tour. We played, you know, to 18,000, 16,000 seater, you know, kind of arenas with people singing Teenage Dirtbag so loud I couldn't hear it. I couldn't even hear the kick drum, you know, anymore. And somehow that little venue, that King Tut's, man, is bigger than all of them when that happens there. I can't explain why, but it is. And you just have this moment of like, oh, like they like, feel gravity anymore, really. You know, they're just the Glaswegians are holding you up with their magic powers, you know. And it's always the crowd that has to push it that extra mile. There's nothing we can really do. We can work really hard and be very well rehearsed, and still it's on them. They always push it over. And that happened this last time. It's happened before, but that's the most recent in memory.
Fantastic. Yeah. Those moments, it's just like it's the high that you're always chasing. There's no, that's the thing. If you get those ones, it's like, this can happen, you know, and it will happen again. But we always ask for a recommendation on this show. Is the Need to Know Music show. So we always ask if you can recommend somebody that people should check out. Is there an artist or a band that you feel people need to know?
Sure. So a couple of artists that I've been discovering lately on Spotify. One of them is Orla Gartland. Hang on one second. I'll give you her information. Yeah, she's an Irish artist. Here she is.
Right.
She's incredible. She's exceptionally talented, but she also has she's a very good guitar player. She's Dodie's guitar player. You know, the English female singer-songwriter.
Yeah, she's great. I love her stuff.
She plays guitar in Dodie's band, and she, Orla, you know, is kind of a rocker in that regard. She's got like the full rock and roll guitar stage show. She's that good. Then she has this like peculiar little lyric thing that she does where she's like really makes you feel like she's admitting something that she's maybe embarrassed about or whatever. The vulnerability, it's rare to have like rock god prowess on an instrument able to be so completely, you know, revealing and intimate on the vocal. So she would be one of my choices in that regard.
Excellent. And is there another one? You said that there's another one.
Yeah, there's some let me see, view artist, finding it here because it's in my recent searches. So artist called Jealous of the Birds.
Okay.
This is brand new. I mean, just last week I discovered this group. Totally killer, like kind of like weirdo alt rock, but like extremely accessible sing along at the same time.
Excellent.
Yeah.
We'll put the links to these on the things up so people can check these guys out. So thanks very much for joining us. And good luck with everything. And I hope that all your next releases will certainly look out for them on here. And next time you're in the UK, if you ever get a chance to travel around again, then pop in and see us. It'd be fantastic to see you.
I think realistically speaking, we're talking about late 2021, you know, maybe early 2022.